going on out there, everybody. And thanks so much for joining us here today on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, kicking it in studio with me, Big Fizzy.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in beautiful Skeleton Studios. Excited and ready to go. I got my Gatorade here. I got my cucumber flavored.
You got your shoes off?
Gatorade. Yes.
Come over here and your drip drops kicked off your slides.
It's dark in here. It's right. Nice and cool. We got the Expanded Perspectives neon sign going in the background.
We got to film. When you get back from vacay.
I know.
We got to film. We got to let them see it, see what they think. We'll throw it up on YouTube. Do some filming.
Well, I saw recently, since you posted and I posted on Instagram, this new logo that we came out with, and it got a lot of people stirred up and excited. So those that are asking, we are going to make t-shirts and we will be getting some stickers. Mm-hmm. As far as like tumblers or anything else like that, coffee mugs, I don't know about that, but definitely stickers and definitely t-shirts.
Yeah.
They are coming because we got to have some ready for the live show.
That's right, folks. I posted about that too. It's on the show. It's on the page on Facebook. I know I haven't put a lot of stuff on Facebook. I'm old. I don't pay attention to a lot of it. I'm dumb. But y'all can go on there on Facebook. If you want to say you're interested, you want to say you're coming, it's all the information is on there. Let us know. Yeah.
Email us. Let us know who you're coming. We know who to look for, you know?
Yeah.
We're going to be talking October 28th. It's a Friday night, 7 p.m. Panther Island Brewery in beautiful Fort Worth, Texas.
Funky Town, baby.
We're going to have special guests there. We're going to have Mike Mays. We're going to have Lyle Blackburn. We're going to have Nick Redfern. It's going to be a blast. We're
going to have Kyle. Kyle's going to be there. I'll be there.
Luke's going to be there. Lil
Fizzy.
Are you kidding?
Lil Fizzy will be there.
Luke's already asked if he can destroy the set like the Eric Andre show. And I'm like, I don't know what kind of show you think we're doing. It's not going to be anything like the Eric Andre show.
You're like, pump the brakes, homie.
You know him. He gets excited.
Yeah, he's ready to rip.
He's practicing the signing of his autograph already. Because
we need to have him do the hype, like to bring us in.
Yeah.
Right? Then we'll have Lil Fizzy go on stage. Here's the thing I love about Lil Fizzy. He's all talk till the lights go on.
yeah, you're right.
Because he was killing it. And we popped that first time we hit him with them lights, and he just went, oh.
Yeah, he just like seized up. He didn't know what to do. You're like,
took a little work. We got him, but it took a little work.
It's just me and Uncle Cam, right? Like in Skeleton Studios, relax. Because he was gung-ho to do the Cameron's Cryptid class.
Oh, yeah.
Boy, and you hit him with them lights, and he just froze.
Didn't know
what to do.
I hope he follows through. I mean, seriously, we're going to have him come out and have to bring us in and all that if he don't lock up. I think he'll do pretty good.
I think so. I've talked about it before. Like when he goes to school and his classmates see him on the Expanded Perspectives YouTube channel, he gets tons of street cred. Those kids lose it. Because
so
they may
funny.
Have older brothers or sisters
That's
or
so ridiculous.
Somebody that they know that has a channel, but it's got nothing compared to the views that Expanded Perspectives get. So they think of him as like a little celebrity.
That's so funny.
It is hilarious.
I'm glad he loves it. Speaking of something that's not hilarious, folks, we got an awesome interview today.
We're
going to throw a few stories at you, but we got to talk to our homie Joshua Cutchin. We ain't got to talk to him in a good bit. And he's such a great guy, man. We got to hang out with him when they were all down. Dude, I miss Cutch. I really do. He's
I do
a good
too.
Dude.
He is a good dude and an incredible author because I like the way he approaches, everything he writes about is the subject matter that I've read in dozens of other books, but he always seems to find a new angle.
True.
That I never thought of, like his other books, like A Trojan Feast and the Brimstone Deceit, Thieves in the Night. Like he always comes at it.
And this one's no different. This one is really wild, right?
Yeah, it's called Ecology of Souls, and it's pretty cool. It talks about, the connections with all these things that I thought were separate actually overlap quite a bit.
Yes.
Very cool. But before we get to the interview with Cutch, check this out. We got a listener story. It says, hello, guys. My name is Jamie, and I'm from Sydney, Australia. I've just discovered your podcast, and I love it. As I was listening to it at work tonight, a listener called in with a story that made me stop in my tracks, as it was so incredibly similar to an experience that I had. As he described the details, my jaw just kept dropping. As he gave more details as he could, and he might as well have been describing my own personal experience to a T. It was far too similar to be a coincidence, and I felt compelled to share my own story. I'm talking about black triangles. I grew up in a rural area of Australia, known as the Southern Highlands, about 1.5 hours drive south of Sydney, and I lived in a very small country town of only a couple hundred people. My family owned a 5-acre property. The property was on the edge of town and sloped down towards a gully on the edge of a national park that started at our fence line. So if you can imagine, it was an open field with a view over the national park. Nothing but beyond our fence line except about 100 miles of rugged bushland. It was in the summer of 1998. I was 17 years old. It was December. I remember that because school hadn't yet broken for summer vacation, and I vividly remember telling my story to my friends the next day. It was about 8 p.m. It was that time of year where the days are starting to become really long, so at that time it was still really light outside. I was indoors, sitting at my desk, playing a game on my computer. Suddenly, I heard my mother, who had been outside hanging clothes on the line, frantically calling me outside. My mother is one of those down-to-earth, raised-in-the-country, no-nonsense types of people who wasn't really prone to getting worked up, so I knew something major was going on. I thought perhaps that our animals were getting attacked or something. There was some kind of problem because we've had livestock being killed by wild animals in the area before. So I rushed outside to see what was up. My mother was standing at the clothesline, looking directly up at something. As she heard me come outside, she pointed to something in the sky and said, "Look at that thing. What the hell is that?" Now there in the sky, just slightly to the west of our property, was something that could only be described as a huge, stationary, dark-colored triangle. As the sky was still light at the shape of the object, or craft, was extremely clear against the sky. It was a perfect triangle. It wasn't moving at all, or making any sound that we could hear. It was just sitting there. It had white lights on the end of each point and a red light in the middle. I got chills when your caller gave out that detail. I estimated its size to be perhaps a little bigger than a large bus. Your caller said his sighting was about the size of 2 houses, which is a pretty good description of what I saw. I also distinctly remember thinking that it had kind of a metallic-looking surface. We just stood in our backyard for what must have been about 5 minutes watching this thing. At some point, my younger brother had joined us, and all three of us just stood there watching, trying to figure out what it was. For all that time, it didn't move, not even 1 inch. And then all of a sudden, it seemed to rotate slightly on its axis and then started to move off, slowly and silently accelerating in a due westerly direction over the national park and eventually disappeared over the horizon. A couple of days later, my mom ran into a neighbor of ours at the local store. The neighbor lived in a house that was maybe 1/2 mile away and had a clear view over our house. Before my mom could even say anything to her, the neighbor said, "What on earth was that thing over your house the other day?" From her house, she had been watching exactly what we had been watching, a huge black triangle. I have no explanation for what it was. All I know is that for 100% certain that it was definitely an artificial craft of some kind. At the time, I tried to rationalize it, like perhaps it was some kind of high-tech experimental craft, an explanation you guys offered up as a possibility. However, it just seemed far-fetched that anyone had that kind of technology and was so much unlike any conventional technology we knew of at the time. But it seemed like the most plausible explanation. However, this happened 24 years ago now. I find it incredibly unlikely that someone could have had that technology so long ago and that it hasn't become known by now. So, I no longer believe that was the case. We were not the only ones to have seen it either, as the next edition of the local newspaper carried an article about how there had been multiple sightings of a UFO reported from all over the Shire that evening. I remember my mom cutting out that article and putting it on the refrigerator. She probably still has it. To this day, whenever we're together, we will occasionally still bring up the black triangle. Anyway, thanks for listening to my story. After hearing your listener's account, I just had to write it in. Keep up the great work. Thanks, Jamie.
Jamie, thank you so much.
Very cool.
Wow.
You know,
I can't imagine what that would feel like, though, to be listening and then hear basically your story, right? You're like, wait a minute, somebody else, I'm not out of my mind.
Right.
Like, that is, I love it. I love the, I don't live it for them because that's really unnerving, but I love the fact that they're you feel better about the whole sighting.
Yeah. It's weird how many people have seen the same triangle, and it's described the same way with the white glowing tips, the red in the center.
Doesn't that seem like that has to be us?
Right? It's kind of like with the Sasquatch thing. I go back and forth. There's days where I'm like, dude, it can't be. It's got to be something we've created. But then
I don't, man.
Why don't we ever use it for anything? It's not like we've been in, I mean, we've been in almost a steady state of war for like the last 30 years.
And if it's that awesome. Right.
We have that kind of power. Why wouldn't you just show up, wreck some stuff, disappear back?
What is this butte? Is this you warping?
That's it. Warping, teleporting. Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Now I'm following along.
I guess I could have programmed some sound effects into the soundboard, but.
I don't even remember what's on that soundboard. I wouldn't hit them because we're not sure what we put on there.
But I'm saying I need to put one on there. We used to do that. I actually won the Golden Knob Award like 2 years in a row. Right?
Yeah. We'll put some back on and we'll get to rocking and rolling. What's this one say, folks?
That's crickets.
Well, that's there we go. So that's about it. Y'all know the headlines are always grabbing me, right?
Yeah.
Too bad our buddy Lon knows the same thing, too. So he loves to mess with us. He puts out amazing things, sends us stuff. We send him all kinds of stuff. You know the game, right?
Yeah.
Then I read this. Bipedal canine attempts to enter truck door in New Mexico. That's right, folks. Right next door, our next door neighbor's got a little dog man problem. Says, I was driving outside of Alamogordo, New Mexico. This occurred in the year 1990, during that, a late night. I was transporting a buddy from Long Island, New York, all the way to Tucson, Arizona. I'd been traveling through the mountains to get to Alamogordo, New Mexico. Then some mutt comes out and stops in the middle of my lane. Thinking that I was going to run it over, I quickly brought the vehicle to a stop. And now I'm towing a trailer behind me, pulling it with my Toyota pickup and this U-Haul trailer. My buddy, of course, is asleep in the passenger seat. So I start yelling at him, wake up and take a look at this. And I open my door to get a better look at this dog. At that moment, the dog stands up on two legs. It had short front legs and a body like a dingo. The eyes were brightly reflecting the light from my headlights. Now, dingoes are native to the continent of Australia. They're not out in the middle of the desert in southwestern United States. This thing then quickly walks up to my door. After making some marks on the glass, it attempted to physically unlock the door. It reared up on its hind legs and was genuinely attempting to raise the door handle like it understood what it was doing. And again, I yelled to my buddy, Dave, wake up. Then he turns his head to the side and said, what is that? Now, the vehicle is a manual transmission, so I dropped it in first gear and began putting things in after all was going on and we're climbing out of this low spot. And I'm thinking to myself that I had no idea what was going on and that I might be losing my mind, that it's likely it would have entered the cab if I hadn't been quick enough to close the door and lock it. I'll never forget this. I'm 44 now. I was maybe 20 at the time, and that's still the strangest thing I've ever seen. My question is, why did you wait till it walked up to the door?
I don't know.
If I saw it stand up, I'm going to just start running through those gears like a NASCAR driver, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm peeling tires, man. I'm out of there.
Yeah, I hear you, man.
A dingo, though. A canine, a walking dogman dingo trying to get into a fella's truck.
I know.
There's no explanation for that. Either the person is completely crazy or that's exactly what happened.
Right.
There's no mistaking that as, oh, it was a homeless guy. In the middle of the desert. That doesn't work.
I don't think we'll ever know.
No.
We'll get to the bottom of that. Let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, we're going to be talking with our buddy Joshua Cutchin about his new book, Ecology of Souls. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Everybody, we got a special guest today. You've heard him before. He's an amazing author. He's a cool guy and a good friend. He's written books like The Trojan Feast and The Brimstone Deceit, as well as Thieves in the Night and Where the Footprints End. Mr. Joshua Cutchin, how you doing, Cutch? What's going on, bud?
I'm doing so good. You know, it was so nice to just be catching up with you guys a little bit before we started. And, you know,
it'll be after we end. So get ready.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I talk to a lot of podcasters and I have, for the most part, really good conversations, and they all seem to be good people, but it's always a little bit more special when you've met the person and you've hung out with them. And yeah, it's always yeah. just still a little bit better. You can, you know, shoot the breeze a little bit more.
Real friendship.
So yeah. yeah, exactly. So it's so good to talk to y'all again. And thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. You're always welcome, man. You continue to blow my socks off every time you drop another book. That's why I'm going bald. You've blown all the hair off. You've done an incredible job again with this one, and I'm not even done with this one, but...
Wait, before we dive in, we were talking about this, and you folks need to know, I think Cutch was the last person we interviewed.
I think so.
We got to go back and look through the lineup. I think he was the last one we had on again, so we've been waiting for him to finish this tome before he can jump on now.
Yeah, so without any more hesitation... Cutch, tell everybody about your latest book, Ecology of Souls. What's it about, and how did you get started down this path?
Well, your socks might stay blown off for a while, because I don't know how I'm going to go back to writing after doing this. It was going to be one book, and the inspiration was something that had sort of been in the back of my mind for a while. You know, I look back through my older stuff, and there are little hints of this eventual book in some of my older work. But there was a quote that had always stuck with me, and it's the quote that opens up the book, which is a quote from Ann Streber, the late wife of Whitley Streber, who we all know from Communion. And after Communion was released in 87, they just got tens of thousands of letters from experiencers who wanted to share what they'd gone through after reading Communion and realizing that they weren't alone. And Whitley says that he walked into their study one day and there were a couple of notes, a couple of correspondences and similarities that she had been noting across all the different letters. And one that she had written that stuck with him and obviously stuck with me was, this has something to do with what we call death. So you take that odd possibility when talking about the UFO phenomenon and alien abductions and things like that. And if you carry that with you, you start to notice things in a lot of these different stories. The number of times that dead loved ones show up in these stories, the number of times that, you know, these aliens, for lack of a better term, impart spiritual messages to people. You know, I'm not saying that they should all be taken on face value, but it does suggest that there's something a little bit more complex going on here than the extraterrestrial hypothesis.
Yeah.
And so I've got that. Oh, yeah. So go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it blew me away when I read that. You were talking about in chapter 10, I believe, you're actually talking about an aviation professional who shared his story with Whitley. And it was something about, I guess, his son or one of his sons passed away recently. And then they had a UFO sighting. And if you'd like to tell that story, I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, I think this might have been in Transformation. I can't recall off the top of my head. A lot of his books end with that shun suffix. Mm-hmm. Whitley got a phone call. I believe it was in the years following Communion, from an FAA personnel member who had their son had died recently, and they had let their dog out, and then there was a commotion in the backyard. So he and his wife stepped outside, and they saw this fireball coming through the house. And they thought it was a crashing plane at first, but, you know, of course, him being an aviation professional, he sort of realized that wasn't what it was. It was something stranger. And when they came inside, they were greeted by their youngest son, who was supposed to be in bed. And they thought that maybe he had seen the fireball himself, but instead he said, "Mom and Dad, there was a little blue man who came into my room and told me that, you know, my brother is okay. And that he's doing well, this and that and the other." You know, and it's interesting because a lot of these connections between UFOs and the dead specifically come from Whitley Strieber. But once you start looking across a lot of the other abduction literature, you'll find vestiges of it in the work of Jenny Randles and Raymond Fowler and just a lot of different other places as well. And it just flat out doesn't get talked about that much. I do think that this has kind of been lurking in the background even before, you know, Anne's observation. I mean, obviously it has, because I go to great lengths of the book to talk about comets being portents of death and all sorts of stuff. And there's tons of stuff we can unpack with that. But I think that if you look at Jacques Vallée's 1969 Passport to Magonia, which is like one of the touchstone works in this field for me, it was the work that really highlighted the similarities between the Fae folk and these alien abduction narratives. You know, Vallée did a great job with outlining that stuff, but there's something that sort of haunts the background of that, which doesn't really get addressed, which is the fact that most cultures, especially the Western European cultures, but I go to great lengths in the book to show that it was really a worldwide association. Most cultures that had some variation of the Fae folk intimately associated them with the dead, to the extent that even if they weren't literally the dead, they would be seen cavorting with the dead. You know, there are all these narratives of people going to fairyland and being warned not to eat or drink by someone that had died a year earlier, right? A neighbor that died. And, you know, you also find these stories of people who come back and they say that they have somehow transitioned to become a fairy or an elf or something like that on the other side. So this idea has been sort of sneaking its way through these sort of uncharted waters for a long time. And I guess in classic Joshua Cutchin fashion, I said, well, let's see what there is to do with that. Let's dig on that a little bit. So I was just going to write a book about UFOs and death. And the more I did it, the more it just kept on building on itself and building on itself and building on itself. And I realized that this wasn't one book, but it was two books. It's volume one and volume two, simply by merit of the fact that I couldn't fit it all in one book, because you end up talking about things like ancient monuments and ley lines and not fairy folk, but also, you know, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, ancient concepts of the soul, polypsychism, the idea that we have multiple souls. And then that's when I said, oh, this is kind of a holistic way to view the entirety of the paranormal. And I'm not sure if it's right or it's objectively true, but it certainly works for me and helps me to reconcile some of the most peculiar things that I've noticed through the years.
Yeah. I mean, again, like, and what I liked chapter 11, the one right after that, when we were just, that you just described about alien abductions, because mostly I'm terrified of aliens, but what I enjoyed was the spirit connection that you made with aliens and UFOs. And I wasn't really aware of this before, but you noted an author named Ivor McKay, and he noted that UFO sightings and hauntings share numerous phenomena. I didn't really know this. Things like noxious odors, aversion to light, psi effects, telepathy. You mentioned telekinesis, levitation, buzzing sounds, and even poltergeist activity. I didn't realize, or I never knew before, or saw the connection between stuff like this and alien abduction. I didn't know that. I thought they were two separate realms, and actually there's like a lot in common.
It's the lines are so blurry that it becomes hard to really distinguish them. And this is something, you know, Jenny Randall's noticed during some of her work in like the late 80s and early 90s in the UK. There was like probably a dozen or two cases that she didn't know whether or not they were near-death experiences or alien abductions, right? A strong case can be made that we just sort of grant the same suite of attributes to whatever is unexplained, you know. So that's why you see the weird Bigfoot stories sometimes give Bigfoot the same abilities and the same, you know, to pass through walls or to float. And right. Obviously that's something with the Fae folk and with aliens. So I think a case can be made for that. Or these are all expressions of a singular phenomenon rather than multiple phenomena, or at least, you know, the Venn diagrams overlap. And that's one of the most common ones is the poltergeist connection. You know, we think of poltergeists as noisy spirits, maybe related to hauntings. Parapsychological literature suggests now that it's usually residual psychokinesis focused around a person who might be undergoing some significant amount of stress. But there was a time when that same behavior was attributed to fairies. Now, you know, as I sort of talked about in Where the Footprints End, Volume 1, if there are plenty of Bigfoot reports that don't have an actual Bigfoot in them, but they do have poltergeist activity that's attributed to Bigfoot, in addition to some cases where there are, you know, poltergeist activity in the house and Bigfoot sightings on the property. But also, yeah, the poltergeist stuff happens with people after they embark on a lot of psychedelic trips. It happens to, obviously, people who are inducted into shamanistic practices in animist cultures. And doesn't get talked about as much as it should, but it's extremely common after near-death experiences and alien abductions. And so it really does lead one to say, what if all these sort of contact modalities, to borrow a term that Ray Hernandez coined, what if all these different contact modalities really are touching the same source? And what if that source is that threshold between the living and the dead? Whatever that means, right? I mean, it's only so much you can write about in a book that's this long anyway. Like, don't need to make it any longer. So I didn't redefine death or the afterlife or anything like that. But yeah, it seems to suggest to me that it's all about crossing that boundary, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities that I didn't know existed. They've been right there in front of me this whole time, never connected the dots, but you somehow did, and now I'm never going to be able to forget it, right? You're right, though. A lot of these near-death experiences that people have are pretty similar to alien abduction stories, and they start to blend and blur together, and you can't really tell which one is which. And you mentioned Kenneth Ring's observations regarding alien abductions and these near-death experiences. What did you find by looking into some of Mr. Ring's observations?
Well, I mean, so Kenneth Ring is sort of like the go-to source for this connection. And he was, you know, sort of really into the near-death experience stuff. And that's when somebody said, hey, you should check out this book. I think it was this Ring's publisher, actually, that said you should check out this new book by this Streber guy. And so he started dialogue with Whitley Strieber, and he realized that there was a lot of overlap between these two experiences. You know, in addition, you have people like Indiana University folklorist Eddie Bullard, who was drawing similar connections between shamanic initiations and alien abductions. But, you know, so many times shamanic initiations in these traditional cultures are a trip to the verge of death. Like, that's the point. You die and you're reborn and you have power over your world. So Ring pointed out a lot of these things. He also pointed out something that we don't normally associate with near-death experiences. Like, in pop culture, we say, oh, well, you know, you get in a bad car accident and you float out of your body and go down a tunnel and meet your loved ones and then come back and all that. But there seems to be a tendency for people to not only be encounter prone, there are people who have UFO sightings and, you know, hauntings in their homes long before they ever have near-death experiences. And of course, vice versa, people have near-death experiences and then they experience all this other stuff as if their perceptions are opened. But one of the things that Ring did was he pointed out that there seems to be a thread of dissociative personality that seems to manifest in a lot of these experiencers, stemming from some sort of trauma, oftentimes trauma in childhood, tragically enough. And that's something else that a lot of alien abduction researchers have noted too. Not that it's necessarily a prerequisite for these experiences, but that it is a common way for people to enter this dissociative state. So it seems like it might be one of, you know, a host of factors that might induce this, but that's definitely a similarity that he noted. And, you know, you see that same dissociation trauma motif manifesting again in these rites of shamanic initiation, which are oftentimes arduous or painful, literal burials alive and rebirths. But something that I found interesting that I don't think people have really talked about is if you look at the changeling phenomenon, where, you know, the fairies substituted one of their own for a human baby, these infants were tortured, right? I mean, that's what Thieves in the Night is about, is the horrible things that people put these suspected changelings through. And, you know, if they were lucky, the fairies would supposedly bring the child back and, you know, they'd have their baby back. But oftentimes these children who had been taken to fairyland would come back and they would have miraculous powers or they would become priests. So it kind of makes you wonder if the whole changeling phenomenon wasn't sort of manufacturing experiencers through this trauma that they were inflicting on these children. In other words, they said, they mistakenly thought it was a changeling and they actually kind of sent their own children to fairyland, so to speak, and brought them back.
Yeah, I mean, I again, the correlations between fairyland visits and near-death experiences, mm-hmm. I wasn't really aware of that. And I like how you described that sometimes someone's loved one or whatever passes away and then they're seen along with these fairies. Sometimes they actually become fairies themselves. And again, so is, say your uncle passes away and then you see him come back and he's a gnome now or something, like, is that a ghost? Is this a face hiding? Like,
I was literally today years old whenever I learned about that. Whenever he put that together, I'm like, it's been staring at us this entire time.
Well, and you know, you look at where these little people tend to appear, and it's almost always around these burial sites, you know, these burial mounds and stuff. I have something that I like to do in one of my presentations where I show a picture of an Irish fairy fort, right? And uh-huh. I show it beside a picture of the Etowah mounds here in Georgia, the Native American mounds here in Georgia that was pre-excavation, so it hasn't been cleared. And I ask people which is the fairy fort and which is the North American mound, and no one can ever tell the difference. Huh. And, you know, I think it's really illustrative for how these things tend to look very similar because, you know, especially here in the southeast of the U.S., a lot of the Cherokee little people are associated with these burial sites, I should say. And a lot of these mounds do contain burials. So, again, it kind of brings into question whether or not that's what we're seeing.
Yeah.
Is you know, these little people are just the dead. And you find that, you know, in Norse mythology, a lot of times there's a strong association between dwarves being the ancestors and stuff. People who leave and they come back and they say, oh, I've become a fairy. It's like, I don't know what to do with that. You know?
Yeah. I don't either. You know, you were mentioning the fairy mounds, and I think it's very interesting, the many similarities between, like you were talking about, New World mounds versus Old World fairy mounds, and how, you know, as a general rule, we find that the richest fairy folklore is amongst the people, the very people that are living near those mounds and those sites. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, why are there so many strange sightings, whether it's cryptid, whether it's fae, ghosts, or even UFOs around these sites? In fact, I liked in the book how you called the mounds in the book as sites of a Neolithic space program.
the Neolithic space program. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because I think there's no denying that that the mounds have always been really strange. Yeah. You know, it's not just modern paranormal thinking that has drawn that conclusion. I don't have the stats in front of me, but there was a survey. Maybe I can bring them up right quick by this gentleman named Bradley T. Lepper, who found that 13 of 38 tribes in the Native American literature, if they didn't credit themselves or their ancestors, didn't know who lived in these mounds and these earthworks that you find all across North America. And at least six of those 38 attributed them to spirits or supernatural races. So again, we have the same motif that you see in the old world, where we have this association between little people and giants and spirits in the mounds. So I find that really compelling if you look at that in the light of how many supposed paranormal encounters take place near the mounds, UFO sightings, Dogman is always around these mounds. I suspect that these spots look so similar for a number of reasons, but I suspect that they look so similar because human beings sort of discovered a set of attributes that they could capitalize upon that would sort of thin the veil at these spots. Because, you know, just one example at the top of my head, the layering that you find in some of these New World mounds, sometimes done at great effort. You know, you'll find mounds in the Midwest that have seashells layered, you know, layers of seashells in between layers of dirt. And you'll find that same layering in other spots. Silbury Hill in England is another good example, which also has a paranormal pedigree behind it. So I suspect that there are a variety of these different techniques in addition to just places on the land where they could sort of capitalize on spirit forces of some sort. That's my working idea. And they could sort of thin the veil. And that's where the idea of the Neolithic space program comes in. Like, we've built the launch pad, right? Yeah. We've trained our astronauts, who are the shamans. Now let's give them the rocket fuel, which is the mushroom or the, you know, the hallucinogenic brew of some sort. And it's just an easier place to contact these things, so much so that sometimes we get bleed over into our waking lives.
I love the idea of what you touched on, because we're all such fae junkies for all of this. I love the idea of maybe the fae realm being where souls have come from, or maybe where souls end up going, like for a reset, And that's why it feels so comforting when they see or when we see them. But it also would explain a lot of why they seem so shocked when we notice them. It explains so much when we realize that maybe we're not near as different as we think. We're just happen to be on. They're on one side of the fence and we're on the other. And every now and again, there's slats missing and we get to look through and see each other.
Well, I love that. You know, you mentioned that surprise because you see that like in all these stories, right? Like you see it in the alien stories and the Bigfoot stories. And sometimes I wonder if there's not like, you know, an alien or a fairy shaman on the other side who's taking some sort of substance or is entering some sort of altered state of consciousness. And that's why they're so surprised, you know. They've come into our realm as opposed to us going into their realm like you see so many times.
Well, I remember a story, not that you had written either, but I remember hearing a story of a person trying ayahuasca for the first time, and they were doing it in New York City. And so they did it in their apartment. They had a person come and administer it and do all this. And he was a Brazilian shaman that was there that had brought it. And he, you know, did the whole thing. This person did it all. And when the person came out, he said, you know, it was crazy. He said, I thought I saw people, your people from the jungles. And he started naming them off. And he was like, yeah, they're here. And he said, they knew you were doing it. So they were there to make sure you found your way back. And so you hear there's a lot of those stories to where people report the exact same thing. And it's one thing to have a mass hallucination when you're all together, whatever it is. But when you got people from around the world having the exact same experience, doing the exact same thing, it starts leading you to like, well, if everybody jumps in the pool, everybody gets wet. I guess you could say water's wet. Like, after a while, it just has to be simple.
No, I got chills with you telling that story, but at the same time, I mean, this is so there are apocryphal anecdotes that people who, you know, if you gave, I think it was, I can't remember exactly who it was, but there's some correspondence between two, pharmacologists, and they said that they actually administered ayahuasca to some Inuit populations, and the Inuits reported seeing jaguars. They described jaguars, even though they've obviously never seen jaguars.
There's some knowledge in that stuff.
I really do think so. And you look at, you know, these other stories where people get this confirmation, much like in near-death experiences, people will get confirmation of people that have passed away elsewhere. And they're the first ones to know about it because they've taken ayahuasca. And it isn't until days later that somebody radios them, you know, they're in the middle of this village in the Amazon basin. And 3 days later, somebody radios and says, oh, your grandfather died. And it's like, yep, already knew that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, right. ayahuasca, the vine of souls, the vine of the dead, again, it keeps on rearing its head. So that's really chilling. I kind of have to wonder if the person in their New York apartment taking ayahuasca, I hope they put down a tarp first.
Oh yeah, I'm sure, right?
Like, yeah.
Get in the tub.
It's not a pretty experience.
DNA over everything, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is so odd though, but I never thought of that until you started what you've written in here with the whole NDE and the Fae realm and the possibility of them taking them to the Fae realm. And there's so much of this starts making a little more sense when we let it get closer, when we quit fighting against it and we just pull back and we let it overlap. Now you're like, it's telling us. We just have to be willing to go get out of our own way and let's let it tell us what it's doing.
Yeah. And with the fae stuff, I mean, so a lot of the reason that we think that fairies are nature spirits, I mean, there's some basis for that in older traditions, but so much of that is a derivation of theosophy. Helena Blavatsky's, you know, movement around the end of the 19th century. Like that's kind of where a lot of that comes from. It reworks some older Paracelsian elementals, but like, again, these cultures tended to think of it as the dead. And sometimes it's really explicit, you know, that they talk about the fairies being seen celebrating at funerals and weeping at deaths. And there's this idea that it's a revolving door between us and the fae folk world. But I really, really like what you said about like stepping back and letting it tell us what it is, because I really want these things to not be from us. And by saying that, I'm not saying that I think that they're hallucinations or I think that we're making them up. I mean, I think that there's some sort of connection between us and these other things. And I don't know how separate they are. And I don't want it to be that way. I want fairies to be nature elementals, and I want Bigfoot to be a hairy monkey, and I want aliens to be something that isn't human, right? Even if they're not extraterrestrial, something that isn't human. But if I sit back and I, again, like you said, Cam, if I sit back and I look at what it's telling me and telling us, I see ample evidence that it is somehow intimately related to us, and that it might be, you know, it might be our ancestors, and it might be a projection of ourselves, a projection of our own souls. That's an idea that I play with in one of the chapters is a Carl Jung idea, actually, the idea that the UFO is sort of a symbol of the exteriorized soul, because the circle is representative of wholeness. And, you know, that sounds kind of silly at first, but then you look at things like the traditions of doppelgangers, right? The idea that you see yourself, and if you see yourself, it's a death omen, because it means that the link between your soul and your body has somehow been weakened. But people in all sorts of cosmologies, indigenous, early Christian, have always conceptualized the soul as a glowing orb of light. And mm-hmm. people see glowing orbs of light sometimes before they die. So is that them seeing their soul? Is the UFO a doppelganger sometimes? I don't know, but it's a fascinating way to look at it. And, you know, I'm left with more questions than I have answers, really.
Well, that's exactly it. It's like you said, it's something has been going on throughout history that has involved the shaman and involved the training that of all of these. And we use the term shaman loosely, but there's no other way to put it. A holy man, whatever it is, mm-hmm. in any area that it is, there's always back in, and they're still that way now. There's always that one person, whether it be at family. I remember reading they like to pass it on from grandfather to grandson or grandmother to granddaughter. So there's no friction between the very next one. It's more of a love and a passing of it and how it plays out. But it's almost something that's taught. It's not necessarily born into as much as it is that it's taught how to look at this stuff, how to live in its realm, how to be able to be invited into its realm. And this has been going on since written history. As far back as we can find anything that has writing, it has stories like this. So there's something there, and they knew something about it. And for some reason, as we have progressed in civilization, we've turned our back on this knowledge, and we've turned our back as this culture now, the European culture that we're in here, we've turned our back on a lot of that. And we look at it as hooey, and we laugh at it, and we make jokes of it. And then we start to build our own thing. Like we're talking about, this has to be UFO. This has to be paranormal. This has to be cryptid. When in reality, it's not. We've learned 1,000-plus years ago it wasn't. We've forgotten it. We thought we could make it better, like everybody has a tendency to do, when in reality,
we want to be important, right?
Yeah, we want what we want to know. The human mind can't not know. It has to have, that's what drives it nuts. That's what drives the idea of the afterlife, is you have to know what's next in order to have comfort, because unknowing is the greatest fear. Unknowing is the one thing that you can't shake. I don't know the outcome. What is going to happen to my person? What, and everybody's that way. And I think we've known it. I just think it's been lost, and you've made some connections that I never thought about, but I believe it's there, is a lot of this stuff is interwoven.
I mean, yeah, cosine. I mean, so yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I use the term, you know, shamanism, I'm speaking very broadly, because you have things like medicine men and yogis and like,
that's a book on its own.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the sort of umbrella term to describe people who have been in touch with this thing, which, again, I think it's been with us for as long as we can remember. And as someone who is still a Christian, I can't help but see that the church played a huge role in us sort of ignoring a lot of these things and saying, you know, it's either God or an angel, or it's all demons. You know,
yes.
That's sort of the way that the church handled things.
It's great marketing.
It's great marketing. And there's a sense of surety there, yes, that really appeals to people. But again, it's that certainty, right? It's what my friend Greg Bishop calls the certainty fetish. And you're right that afterlife beliefs tend to play into that in a very big way. At the same time, if you look at these experiences and the after effects that they have on people, and by these experiences, I mean near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, trips to fairyland, cryptid encounters, psychedelic trips, and even alien abductions. If you look at the surveys that have been concluded afterwards, time and again, people say that they're less afraid of death. They're aware that there's something bigger to it, which is sort of one of the refrains of the book that comes up, is this idea of dying to death. You sort of remove that fear of the unknown from your life so that you can actually, you know, better your existence here, better your fellow man here. man, woman here, and to really concentrate on bettering these things and occupying yourself with loftier goals, as opposed to being mired in this simple question of like, do we survive or not? You know, and that dying to death thing just keeps coming back time and time again. And I would argue that it goes all the way back probably to something like the Eleusinian mysteries, when there were all those other Greek mystery cults where people would, perhaps in some of these proposed models, they would take entheogens and they would descend into a cave and they would come out reborn. And they would always say, blessed are those who enter Eleusis, because they now have died to death. It's the same idea again, time and time and time again.
The rebirth is something that's very popular in all of shamanism. And it's something that I never thought about it. Like when you were talking about with the changelings and the bringing it, of course I love the fae stuff. But it just starts making sense. A lot of these things start clicking that it's like you have to get out of your own way. And that's finally like, oh man. Well, like we even talked about, it's something about the mounds like you brought up or any of these old sites that have these strange things happening. It's always like the veil is thinner. It's somehow, for some reason, we talk about it in Missing 411 with missing people. That stuff comes up when they just completely vanish. There's no other explanation. Either they went off in a hole.
Or they're in fairyland.
Or they're just not in this realm anymore. Something happened where they passed through. We have stories before where they talk about seeing gnomes, the fae, leprechauns, whatever, going through what appear to be solid objects. They easily go right into granite. They easily go into a tree, into this, into a mound. But then you go over there, you're like, well, how come it's not working for me? It's like, well, because you're really not the same thing. You are, and you aren't. You know, wolves and chihuahuas are dogs, yes, but they're not quite the same thing.
I never heard of anyone getting shot by fae folk until this book.
Yeah,
I never
heard of that.
Elf bolts, elf shot, elf arrows, these invisible spirit projectiles. And it isn't just in one location. Like all around the globe, people have these traditions where they talk about loved ones were struck with these invisible ghost darts and they were killed. How did you stumble upon this?
Well, I'd always kind of been aware of it. And Allison Jornland and I will be partnering sometime after I decide I'm going to write again, probably on a book on these spirit darts, because she completed an essay for me for this book on fairy films, which will be out at some point. We'll see. But she had done a lot of work on that, and that really sort of hit me to the fact that this is stuff like fairy shot and elf shot and things like that. You know, we typically see this in Western Europe and places like that, as people uncovering old, you know, Neolithic arrowheads and deciding that they must be from the fae folk. But there was also this idea that, you know, the fairies and elves and whatnot could inflict pain from a distance. And, you know, this sometimes manifested as something called the fairy blast. And blast shares the same root words with blister and blustery, because the idea was that fairies who traveled on the wind could hit you with a blast of blustery air and leave a blister. And inside that blister, if it was lanced, would be any number of just objects, twigs, bits of rock, eggshell, bone, leaves, just any number of things, right? But it's always just trash. But it really does nest quite neatly into that spirit dart phenomenon that you see in a lot of indigenous tribes. It's especially common in the Amazon, but also amongst, for example, the Yoruba. To this day, I think there are specifically some medical doctors who've documented like Yoruba people who believe that they've been afflicted with witchcraft, and they open them up and they sure enough have some sort of mundane foreign body inside them. Well, what does this sound like? You know, it sounds like all these stories of alien implants. It really does.
Yeah.
You know, I love ufology and I love a lot of the people, and there's a lot of good work out there, but these things are never impressive when they're excised, right? They always look mundane. Mm-hmm. And of course, the claim is, oh, well, they're so advanced that they look mundane, right?
Right.
But I think it's a lot. It makes a lot more sense to me to fit it and to nest it into that sort of spirit projectile category, because it seems to be very similar to what we're seeing. Just like with the fairy blast, you lance these things open, and it's always a bit of calcified iron, or you know, something like. You know, some skeptics say that people have injuries and they get a bit of porcelain under their skin and it calcifies, and that's what it is. Well, that's would be completely consistent with what people reported with this fairy blast phenomenon in Western Europe.
It's so wild, yeah, man. It's
crazy.
I've got another thing too. Is like on the cover of the book is Terrence McKenna, and I've been a big Terrence McKenna fan. But when you added all this to it, I remember lots of people. You want to have rock solid evidence. A lot of people are like, yeah, but you're talking about fairies and fae and UFOs and all this. There's a story. There's an account that his brother Dennis McKenna tells of the time that he and Terrence went down south deep and started taking literally hero doses of mushrooms. And I remember the story of Dennis saying that he and Terrence carried on conversations together and they weren't even in the room together. And they both remember exactly what the other one said. And there were people there with them that weren't on mushrooms. It was just them two and they had people with them and they were in separate rooms and carried on full conversations that both of them fully recalled. And that always stuck with me is now it makes sense after reading this of why all the shamans always use it. Is because it's easier to get through that veil, like we've always talked about.
Yeah.
Like people report seeing machine elves. They talk about seeing the jaguars. It's like it allows you to peer through the mist just long enough, but you have to be in the right mindset. And it's not always psychedelics. It can be done with breathing when they learn how to do this, with mm-hmm. meditation. But it's like the psychedelics let you get in there quicker and easier, and it's almost a natural, like they talk about with the ayahuasca. It when you let it in, it envelops you, it hugs you back. You just have, and for it to be so natural, it's like you brought up, it almost takes the fear of death away completely, because you're like, oh yeah, we are all just one big thing. That's really all this is. Like, we can't really go anywhere. We're all just going to be like, oh yeah, is it my turn again? I mean, that's it.
I mean, yeah, I get the impression that once you make it past that boundary, it's all like, what was I so worried about? You
know? Like, I feel like this might be the worst part. Like, where we're at right exactly. now is like the starting blocks, right? Like, this is the worst part. The best truly is yet to come.
Yeah, you wind up in very Eastern ways of thought when you look at this. But yeah, Saint Terry of McKenna is on the cover.
Yes.
And even the term ecology of souls, I'm not sure if he originated the term, but he used it once to describe one possibility of the DMT realm. He said, you know, one of the more conservative possibilities is that perhaps you've slipped into an ecology of souls. And sure enough, I mean, he supposedly claimed to have turned on a highly positioned lama, Tibetan Buddhist lama, to DMT. And the lama said that it was familiar to him. He said, yeah, that's as far as you can go without passing the point of no return. To Ooh. Which Terrence started calling it the bungee cord into the bardo. But you were talking
You've
about
listened
like,
to too many of his talks.
Oh, dude, every year I try to listen to about three or four of his lectures and I just sort of get lost in it. But yeah. And, you know, sure enough, some of the reductionists are saying that, well, DMT, which is present in all of us, so closely mirrors the structure of the near-death experience that must be what near-death experiences are. And it never really says, well, maybe DMT's again, the rocket fuel mm-hmm. to blast you into that next plane of existence.
That's the self-destruct button. Whenever it's down at the end, it's like, are you tired of this now? You ready to go?
Right? Exactly.
Punch the
exactly.
button and it ignites the rocket. We got to go.
Big red DMT button.
Yeah, just bang it. It's going to be a great time after this. Come on.
but yeah, and I think that, I mean, what a fantastic thinker and someone who's certainly his influence is all over this book, as evidenced by the cover and, you know, the dadgum title. But he was really playing with this idea that it was exactly as a lot of the shamans had said. He told a great anecdote, great story time and again, which speaks to what you were talking about. Like, you don't have to take quote unquote drugs to get there. You can also meditate and do different spiritual practices. I suspect that this thing on the other side, whether it is us or whether it's something truly alien, can also just reach out and say, hey, you get to experience this right now too.
I think
it can just reach through on its own. But Terrence used to tell a story about a young monk who was practicing a city of levitation so that he could cross the river. And he did. He actually was able to levitate. And he goes up to the way Terry would tell it was he goes up to the Buddha later and he says, oh, I've been practicing and I can levitate. I levitated myself across the river. And the Buddha says, yeah, but the ferry only costs a nickel. So the idea was that, like, yeah, you can do these practices. but there is,
or you can just drink the tea.
Yeah. And that really ties into some of Carl Jung's ideas on alchemy as this process of self-improvement, because in alchemy, there were two ways to turn lead into gold. One was the wet way and one was the dry way. And the wet way was slow and methodical, but safe, and it would get you there. And the dry way was a rocket ship, and it was hazardous, but it would get you there a lot quicker. And that, to me, very much sounds like what we're dealing with when we're talking about reaching these states of altered consciousness. Like, you can meditate and get there, or you can maybe risk your sanity and you know, drink the tea.
And right? It's not for everyone. Like, yeah, meditation's probably for everyone, but drinking that tea ain't for everyone. It's just like everything else, right? Like, certain things, look, pizza sauce doesn't agree with me. Psilocybin may not agree with you. I don't know. Yeah,
you know, I talk about this stuff a lot, and I'm pretty straight edge. So I haven't done it for a couple
of years. Yeah. Me and Kyle, we've never done it either.
Yeah. We're wink. But, you know, I've had some people come up
we're
to
doing
me
it now.
Like, well, how can you talk about this stuff without having done it? And my response is, well, then you're saying that an astronomer can't talk about space unless he's an astronaut. Like, it doesn't make any sense, you know. So I can rely on the testimony of others to give me some idea. And that testimony is always strikingly consistent. And again, I was just, especially with the psychedelic stuff, I was struck by how often people report traveling into the realm of the dead, and how many of these things were primarily conceived of as being a means of contacting the world of the ancestors, the world of the dead. I mean, ayahuasca, obviously, but stuff like salvia and even iboga as well were always thought of as primarily a means of entering the world of the dead, in addition to just a generalized world of spirits.
And it's probably best that you don't, because then it gives you an unbiased view of what you're hearing and laying out. You don't want to be on that team, right? You don't want to be in there and you realize now how awesome it is. And then now you're cheerleading and you're forefronting everything, when in reality, it might be better to be analytical the way you're approaching it now.
Yeah, there are some days, though, when I'm like, man, I just want to see the little people, you know.
Yeah, whenever you get down, just let us know.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, you've done.
Because we'd love to go to the fairy realm. If you're going, we're going.
Yeah,
right, I would love to see that. I don't want to eat anything there, but I'd like to just take a look in there.
Be sure to take a friend and a towel.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Hitchhiker's Guide. There we go.
Well, Joshua, my hat's off to you again.
Yes. This
Ecology of Souls, an amazing book. There's like two volumes, right? It's so large, the publisher couldn't even fit it in one book. They had to make it in two.
Yeah, that was, so I know that some people will be like, you're nickel and diming, and I'm not nickel and diming. I don't trust Amazon's binding, because it is self-published through Amazon. I don't trust Amazon's binding to do it. So it's available, depending on the way you look at it, there are four books, right? So there's volume one, there's volume two, which is just one book, but it's split into two separate volumes because of space concerns. I also opted to not include any of the end notes or references or three appendices, which feature the dead appearing during alien abductions. Three appendices, those are available either as another print volume called The Ecology of Souls Companion, or I've made them freely available on joshuacutchin.com, because if you buy the books, you have the right to see where the information comes from, right? So this is just for print completionists. No need to buy all three. And then, you know, the most financially reasonable route is to just get the ebook, which has all the endnotes in there as well as one. It's volumes one and two in just the single ebook.
Are you going
to
do the audiobook version? Read it yourself. We're waiting.
You are like the 12th person to ask me about this.
I'm expecting it next week.
The main thing that's holding me back is there's some stuff that I look at and I'm like, I don't know how the heck to pronounce this. Like,
let me read it for you. I'll just pronounce it however I want.
Exactly.
Everybody hates me when I do it anyway, so I'll just do it for you too.
Just get over it.
Yeah. Well, do you have any, other than Amazon, is there any other places people can purchase the book?
You can also contact me directly. It's for autographed copies. I'm doing something on Amazon. I'm offering a discount for buying them all together that you just can't do through Amazon. So
awesome.
Yeah, I wanted to self-publish this because I wanted to see what the experience is like. It's a tough experience to self-publish. Tim and I self-published Where the Footprints End, but he did all the layout and he did all the artwork. So I was like, okay, well, what happens if I do this on my own? Well, it's a lot of work, but it was fun. And it was a good learning process. But, you know, also I kind of felt like you know, these directors who like get some success and then they have an idea and they kind of want to shop it around, but they're kind of convinced that all the studios are going to tell them to take stuff out and to change stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
You know what? I wrote Ecology of Souls first and foremost for me, and I wanted this to be exactly what it is that's out there right now. So,
well, you did an amazing job. So.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, y'all. I appreciate it.
Do you have any appearances coming up?
So yeah, I got some stuff coming up. This weekend I will be in Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm really excited. It's a real rogues gallery of folks who are going to be there. Myself, Micah Hanks, Ryan Sprague, or just some of the ufological people who are going to be there. That is the Midwest Conference on the Unknown. You can find that at cape-events.com. Like I said, it's late notice. It's this weekend, but it should be a really fantastic time. Then next weekend, I'm going to be in Franklin Grove, Illinois at the Worldwide Metaphysical Tribe doing a talk on Bigfoot. And we're also going to have a CE5. We're going to try to call down the UFOs, which
nice.
Is gonna be it's going to be interesting to see if it does anything, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I feel like I'm paranormal kryptonite, but I'm coming in with an open mind. And then Labor Day weekend, I will be at Dragon Con here in Atlanta.
Nice.
Doing the paranormal track on that. So, yeah, looks like I've got a very busy couple of weeks ahead of me, but it's going
to
be fun.
Well, that sounds awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on and talking to us today, Joshua.
Thanks, brothers. It's been so much fun.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. That was an awesome interview with Joshua Cutchin. It's so much fun to have him on every time because he blows my mind with some of the stuff he finds. That I don't know where the guy's digging to find this stuff and why no one else has made these parallels.
His brain doesn't work the same as everyone else's.
I'm telling you.
Right? Like, he looks at things literally completely different. And I appreciate that so much. It's Kyle and I get excited when there's fresh stuff. Right. Like when there's fresh ideas, fresh new takes, because it's been the same and it's just been looking over the same things. And then when he comes out with this odd stuff and we say fresh, it's been here this whole time.
Right,
he's just finally been the man to drag it into the light and put it on display.
Yeah, I love talking with him. I love reading his books. His books are fantastic. If you've never picked up a paranormal book by Joshua, you definitely need to check it out. I'll put links to it in the show notes and everything, but it's called Ecology of Souls. This book just came out, and it is impressive. Also, you should check out his other work, like A Trojan Feast, The Food and Drink Offerings of Aliens, Fairies, and Sasquatch. Not only can you buy that book, but if you go back, you can listen to us do an interview with him about that book.
Oh, yeah.
Also, he has Thieves in the Night, A Brief History of Supernatural Child Abductions. That was a good one. And The Brimstone Deceit, An In-Depth Examination of Supernatural Scents and Otherworldly Odors. Again, I had no idea about that kind of stuff. And then Where the Footprints End, High Strangeness, and the Bigfoot Phenomenon. Incredible job.
Yeah.
I love it when we have him on. And he said he's going to take a little break for now, but then I'm sure he'll be coming up with another banger in the next
year. He's got to take a break. That thing's massive.
It is.
A massive double tomes that he's got whipped out there.
Well, in the beginning of the show, we read that UFO, that triangle UFO sighting from Australia. And I remember... Do you remember meeting David Marler at like the Ozark UFO conference?
Yep.
And he wrote a book about triangle-shaped UFOs. So I need to reach out to him, see about getting him on the program.
Yeah, he was great speaking, too. That was really interesting stuff.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
But on the thread of UFOs and alien abductions and things like that, I got a recent call from a U.S. Marine named Jay who had a strange sighting of an orb. Check this out.
Hey, Cam and Kyle. My name is Jay Lee. I'm an ex-Marine. I live in Virginia currently. When I was in the Marine Corps, I was working out in California, Camp Pendleton, up in the mountains. You know how it gets, California being the number one for sightings. It was actually kind of an interesting night. We were all doing an exercise out there, and I happened to just look up in the sky, and here I see this bright red dot just kind of shoot up from the ground. And at first, I really thought it was a flare. I thought it was a flare for sure. And then I looked, there was no smoke trail. And it was a very clear night. You could see all the stars. And I was like, all right, this is a weird situation here. And then I just watched it for probably about 5-6 minutes. And it just got brighter and brighter. And I was asking people, I was like, hey, y'all see this? And they were like, yeah, I see it. It's probably just a flare. I was like, no, watch it. So I watched it. And it got smaller and smaller. And when it got really, really small, it took off at like a few thousand miles an hour at minimum. I have no idea how fast it went. But it was almost a blink of an eye. It shot up into the sky, stopped, shot up again, stopped. And then it shot across horizontally, almost like a straight plane to the outer edge of the earth. Like, that's what it looked like. It just, and away it went. And I was like, what the hell was that? And I just watched it, and it floated and floated. It slowed down, floated, and then, boom, disappeared. I was like, yo. Anybody else saw that? They're like, yeah, man, that was kind of trippy. I was like, yeah, that wasn't a flare. They're like, nah, I don't think that was a flare. But up in the mountains, we were probably about, I'd say, an hour and a half from a good piece of the ocean. And, I mean, it was just an interesting experience. And I never really knew what it was, but the fact that, you know, this bright red object shoots up into the sky, stops, shoots up again, stops, shoots up again, stops, and then takes off. I mean, it all happened within the course of 15 minutes. I mean, I feel like that might be typical for a flare, but again, there was no smoke at all. It was just a weird, weird thing. Bright moon, too. Like, you could see, you would be able to tell if there was smoke. And, I mean, there was a fire up on the mountain about 3 hours after that. It was a weird night. But yeah, I also wanted to thank you guys for putting on such an amazing podcast. But yeah, seriously, thank you guys. You guys are amazing.
And we're back. Very cool story. Thank you, Jay.
Thanks for sending. I love it when y'all call in.
First of all, thank you for your service. You know, yes. We appreciate it. If you have a story you want to share with me and Cam or the audience, please call the hotline, 888-393-2783, 888-393-BRUD. Or you can email. I understand if you don't want your voice on there, you can email the show expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. If you don't want us to use your name, that's fine. Make up an alias or tell us. Make up a pseudonym, whatever you want. But share the story. These are the types of stories that need to be told, that need to be shared. You 100%. Never know where your sighting, as crazy as it sounds, is told on the air, and then someone like Jamie in the beginning hears it, and they had the same experience.
Help someone else. We never know. Right? That's why, yeah, we just keep sharing it.
Cam, what do you got planned for the rest of your week?
Man, oh man, just doing a little work. I know you're going out of town, so I'm going to be doing a little work, hanging out around the house, just not really a whole lot of crazy stuff too much. Getting ready to move my daughter back down to college.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like much fun. Nobody likes moving.
Oh, man, she's got a lot of stuff, so we're going to move her into her apartment and all that. And town down there is always busy, like every big college town. So when it's move-in weekend, it's madness down there. So
right.
I don't miss that. I didn't miss it last time. I'm not going to miss it this time, but we're going to go through it. But, yeah, that's about all I got going on, man. Nothing. I don't have anything crazy happening right now, but it's building to it. ReaperCon.
Yeah, oh yeah, ReaperCon. Yeah,
ReaperCon in a month. You'll be up there too, but I'm going to be up there pretty much the whole time. So, folks, if you're into it, like we always said, I told y'all before, if you're into tabletop role-playing and miniatures and gaming and all that stuff like D&D and whatnot, ReaperCon's going to be in Denton, and Reaper's a big company that makes miniatures, and we're lucky to be this close to them. So they're going to have a miniature painting contest and have all the kind of paint stuff going on. It's just a big, like, I think it's the 1st through the 4th of September, I think is when it is. So I'll be up there hanging out. I'm going to get Philly to come up and hang out with me for a day or so. We'll look around up there. It's just going to be fun. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. That's the only big plans I have going on right about now, besides you know, you got the cool stuff. You get to go fish.
Yeah, we're going fishing down at the coast. The final hoorah for the summer of 2022. Yep. The kids go back to school in like 2 weeks. So we're going to do one more trip. Before we get out of here, don't forget about our sponsor, Microdose Gummies. Microdose is available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, go to microdose.com and use the code EXPANDED to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. That's about all the time we have for this episode. Till next time, folks, I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.